Ladies and gentlemen, I would ask you to take your seats. So it's my great pleasure to welcome you all to this inaugural session of the 39th Annual World Conference on Lung Health. It is, in fact, a great honor for me to address you as President of the Union. I'm deeply conscious of the fact that I'm following in very august footsteps in the form of Asma El Soni and Anne Fanning. I doubt that I will live up to their weight. I've had the privilege of growing up in a professional sense in the era when the Union's influence really started to make an impact at country level. For me, that was in the early 1990s when I was head of the Department of Medicine in Lilongwe, Malawi. And at that point, the standardized approach to TB management had been rolled out across the country in accordance with the five arms of the DOTS strategy. The benefits were obvious and very motivating for the whole of the health sector. It was, however, also a very challenging time, because just as the DOTS success was becoming apparent, the effects of HIV and deepening poverty began to take their toll on the health system. And as a consequence, the TB program suffered. It was clear to me as a young physician, however, that there was something special about the driving force behind the DOTS strategy of the time, and that was the Union. I'm proud to say that it motivated me to become an individual member. Since those days in Malawi, from my position as an academic physician at the School of Tropical Medicine in Liverpool, I've had the pleasure of continuing to work with my colleagues in Malawi, and as the years have gone by, with other colleagues working in TB control around the world. Those of you who know me and the work that I've pursued will know that I am passionate about the needs of the millions of people around the globe who live in poverty, and I'm passionate about their rights to much easier, earlier, and free access to TB diagnosis and treatment. My work has always resonated with the mission and values of the Union, which has continuously expressed its solidarity with the poor in the way that it goes about achieving its mission of promoting lung health in low and middle-income countries. It's a happy coincidence, therefore, that today is International Day for the Eradication of Poverty. As President of the Union, I'm delighted to stand shoulder to shoulder with the ideals expressed in the naming of such a day. The Union today has changed dramatically from the organization that I joined 14 years ago, in one sense. It's grown into a vigorous, muscular, professional organization with increasing influence extending beyond tuberculosis and lung health and into wider arenas of public health and development. At the center of this growth and change is an energetic institute. Many of us previously called it the Secretariat. Much of the credit for this growth goes to the unstinting energy and vision of our executive director, Dr. Niels Bülow. In another sense, however, the organization has not changed. It's still an organization that defines itself and its global reach by its membership. The Union membership is the lifeblood of the Union's independence and the source of inspiration for its innovations. As the Union goes forward from today, I pledge myself wholeheartedly to all our members. I pledge myself to the current and future individual members of our four scientific sections, tobacco control, HIV, lung health, and tuberculosis. All of these are ably supported by the Institute membership and communications expertise that we now have, and all of these have counterparts in the departments of tobacco control, HIV, lung health, and tuberculosis within the Institute. I also pledge myself to the current and future organizational and constituent members. Some of you may not really have it clear in your minds that in addition to our individual membership, The union is a federation of professional respiratory and anti-TB societies from around the globe, our constituent members. I applaud those constituent members for their support. I urge them to stay with us, and I urge all of you to reach out and encourage more organisations to join as organisational members and constituent members where needed. We're especially looking at national level for patient organisations, nursing and other health professional organisations, HIV organisations and tobacco control organisations to join us. Finally, ladies and gentlemen, as my final message for this World Conference, I pledge myself to the continued mission of the Union to work for the poor of the world. Thank you very much. It's now a pleasure for me to introduce Mr. Louis-Charles Viossa, who is the ambassador for the fight against AIDS and communicable diseases. While I try to use my broken French, I would urge those of you who need translation from French to English to put your headphones on now. That way there'll be less rustling by the time the ambassador takes the podium. So Mr. Louis-Charles Viossa is from the French Ministry of Foreign and European Affairs. He has taken time out of a busy schedule, and we thank him very much for coming here to support the endeavours, missions and values of the Union. So, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Ambassador chargé de la lutte contre le sida et les maladies transmissibles.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's a real pleasure and a great honor to be here today with you in Paris at the opening session of this World Conference. And I would like to thank the Union and its president for their very kind invitation. I want to convey the apologies of Mr. Alain Joyandet, State Secretary for Cooperation and Francophonie, who was not able to be here today. But Minister Joyandet asked me to read a message on his behalf, and I'll turn now to French. Mesdames et messieurs, permettez-moi tout d'abord de vous souhaiter, au nom du gouvernement français, la bienvenue à Paris à l'occasion de cette 39e conférence sur la santé respiratoire. Depuis de nombreuses années, la France soutient les actions de l'Union internationale contre la tuberculose et les maladies respiratoires. Et je me félicite de constater que grâce à son action, la mobilisation contre la tuberculose est plus forte que jamais. Votre présence aujourd'hui à Paris le prouve et je vous en remercie. La tuberculose a marqué l'histoire des sociétés occidentales et a frappé d'innombrables familles dans leur chair. Certes, des progrès très importants dans la connaissance et dans le traitement ont été réalisés pour lutter contre la tuberculose depuis la seconde moitié du siècle dernier. Il faut nous en féliciter. Mais les progrès réalisés au Nord ne doivent pas nous conduire à négliger la situation dans le reste du monde. Or, elle est préoccupante, très préoccupante même. Il y a encore plus de 9 millions de nouveaux cas de tuberculose chaque année dans le monde. Près de 2 millions d'hommes, de femmes et d'enfants meurent chaque année de la tuberculose. La tuberculose est la principale infection opportuniste du sida. Et on assiste enfin à un développement rapide de formes multi- et ultra-résistantes qui sont parfois terrifiantes. Alors que c'est une maladie évitable et curable, la tuberculose est toujours un problème majeur de santé publique sur notre planète. Et cette maladie est un handicap énorme pour le développement économique et social du monde et d'un continent comme l'Afrique qui me tient tout particulièrement à cœur. Pour toutes ces raisons, la France est déterminée à lutter sans faille contre la tuberculose. Notre mobilisation financière est très importante, de l'ordre de 110 millions d'euros par an, ce qui fait de mon pays l'un des tout premiers bailleurs dans le monde. L'essentiel de notre effort passe par deux acteurs clés dont nous sommes les principaux financeurs. Unitaid, tout d'abord, qui a été créé par la France, avec d'autres pays, il y a 2 ans environ, s'est déjà engagé à financer 100 millions d'euros, ce qui va permettre de traiter 750 000 enfants dans une soixantaine de pays et 25 000 patients atteints de formes multirésistantes. Le Fonds mondial, ensuite, nous lui versons 300 millions d'euros par an, dont près de 45 millions sont consacrés à la tuberculose. À la mi-2008, les actions du Fonds mondial ont déjà permis d'assurer un diagnostic et un traitement à près de 4 millions de personnes dans le monde en développement. Sur un plan bilatéral, l'AFD, l'Agence française de développement, mobilise environ 8 millions d'euros en faveur de la lutte contre la tuberculose. Notre mobilisation porte ensuite sur l'objet même de votre conférence, le renforcement des systèmes de santé. C'est un enjeu tout à fait majeur pour l'efficacité de la lutte contre la tuberculose et le sida également, car les deux maladies sont fréquemment associées. Une prise en charge efficace nécessite un personnel de santé formé, des infrastructures hospitalières adaptées, un accompagnement constant des patients, indispensable à la bonne observance, seul garant du succès thérapeutique, ainsi que la gratuité des soins, qui est un point essentiel. Dans ce cadre, nous sommes particulièrement soucieux de mettre l'accent sur deux piliers principaux, la couverture du risque maladie d'une part et le développement des ressources humaines en santé d'autre part. Ce message clé, la France le porte avec force dans le cadre de sa présidence de l'Union européenne, mais aussi dans le cadre de sa politique multilatérale et bilatérale. Et nous nous efforçons de le faire comprendre par l'opinion publique également. C'est dans cet esprit que j'ai lancé une grande campagne d'information sur les objectifs du millénaire pour le développement, 8 fois oui, il y a un mois à Paris. J'attends beaucoup de vos travaux afin que nous puissions progresser encore dans la connaissance des mécanismes et des dispositifs les plus efficaces pour renforcer les systèmes de santé. La recherche est essentielle en effet à mes yeux. La France a d'ailleurs une longue histoire et de nombreux atouts dans ce domaine, depuis l'ANEC jusqu'aux équipes de l'Institut Pasteur que nous soutenons activement. Pour conclure, je vous souhaite d'excellents travaux au cours des prochains jours et un très bon séjour à Paris. Je vous remercie.
So it's now a further pleasure for me to introduce Dr. Jacob Kumarasan. Sorry, Jacob. Stumbling here. Many of you will remember Jacob when he was Executive Secretary of the Stop-TB Partnership, and that's also the time when I first met him, first in Montreal, when he treated us to a lecture which involved rupees under the seats. I don't know if you remember that, Jacob. Equally further, he presided over a very successful Stop-TB forum in New Delhi. Prior to that, though, if I may take you back, Jacob was born in India, and his education was at Kilpauk Medical College. He went on to Tulane University, and from there worked in Zimbabwe, moving on to WHO, the Stop-TB Partnership. And from the Stop-TB Partnership went on to the Trachoma Initiative, and has recently taken up the position of director of the WHO Center on Health and Development. So please welcome Dr. Jacob Kumarasan.
Thanks for the introduction, Bertie. My dear friends and colleagues, it gives me a great honor and a wonderful privilege to be with you this evening and to deliver the special guest lecture at the inaugural session of the 39th Union World Conference on Lung Health. There's a statement which goes as follows: blessed are those who deliver short speeches, for they shall be invited again. I want to thank Dr. Niels Billow and Michael Kimmerly for inviting me. It's good to be in Paris and back at the Union again, and I intend to be invited again. The June 2005 issue of the New England Journal of Medicine reported on a case of pneumonia in a 17-year-old girl who was treated with local antibiotics at a local clinic. She returned a week later, her right side of the face had dropped, her right arm and legs were paralyzed, and she was aphasic. A chest radiograph revealed hydropneumothorax, and a brain scan showed 4 abscesses. Following a rapid diagnosis and a combination of IV antibiotics, she recovered fully, thanks to the health systems and the people who manned it. The diagnosis was tsunami lung, a very rare condition which hopefully happens very rarely. Although this was a successful case, we do not know whether the same was happening in other parts of the world or whether people were undetected and died. My question to you now is the health systems an asset or is it a liability? How many of you would say that it is an asset? Just show me your hands. Very good. How many of you say that it's a liability? Okay. I'm not here to change your opinions. I'm here to give you an assessment of what I feel. Lung health compresses a wide range of conditions from acute infections such as pneumonia and bronchitis to chronic conditions such as asthma and chronic obstructive pulmonary diseases. According to the latest WHO estimates of 2007, there are 300 million people who have asthma, 210 million who have chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, and there are millions who have allergic rhinitis and other undiagnosed respiratory conditions. If you look at the death toll, acute respiratory infections alone account for 4 million deaths per year, and tuberculosis accounts for 1.5 million deaths. Now, how can we manage or even cope with such a large burden? But there is a way forward, and that is through collaborations and partnerships. The Stop TB partnership is a good example of this collaboration which occurred since 2000 to realize the goal of eliminating tuberculosis as a public health problem. It started as a very small number of individuals and institutions working together, as you can see in the graph, less than 100 in the year 2000, but it evolved due to excellent people who are now working there to a network of international organizations, countries, donors, public sector, private sector, governmental, non-governmental organizations working together to achieve a common goal. What is equity? Equity is the absence of avoidable or remediable differences in populations or groups defined socially, economically, demographically, or geographically. Now, health equities does not involve only inequalities in health, but it's also a failure of the system to avoid and overcome such inequalities. Now, I'd like to review the literature which is available on health equity and lung diseases in the following areas: distribution, access to care, diagnosis, treatment, and treatment outcome. Now, we all know that TB is a disease of poverty. The poorer populations are 2 times more likely to have TB, 3 times less likely to have access to care, 4 times less likely to complete TB treatment, and 5 times more likely to incur impoverishing payments for TB care. And this was work done by Tim Evans. We also know that the highest TB rates per capita are in Africa, and the vast majority of TB deaths happen in the developing world, mostly in Asia. Now, this map shows you the distribution of the worldwide TB incidence, but if we go deeper into this, the red sections and the yellow sections are the ones which are so-called high-burden countries. The incidence is higher in the rural areas. But if you look at the developed world, which is UK and the other low-incidence countries, the incidence is largely in the urban areas. Now, in the United States, if we go further, the rates of US-born African-Americans are 8 times higher than US-born white population. Now, the same kind of a regional variation is also seen in asthma prevalence. And this data here shows that the rates in children 13 to 14 years old is about 4 to 5 times lesser in Southeast Asia and Eastern Europe as compared to North America and Oceania. And if you go into one region, and you can look here at the rates of Mexico, it's three times lesser than that of Brazil, and Brazil is half that of Peru. So you can see the vast variations in the asthma lifetime prevalence in the same groups of children. And mortality has the same issues. The average is 0.18 per 100,000, but look at the vast differentials between Czech Republic and the United Kingdom at the bottom, a four-fold differential. We know this very well, that TB rates can be influenced by socioeconomic factors such as biological, behavioral, social, and environmental, and this work shows that with decreasing socioeconomic status, meaning increasing crowding, lesser income, more poverty, and unemployment, the rates of TB increases twofold to fourfold. Now, moving on to access to care, the pathway to care for poor people is very complex and influenced by economic, socio-cultural factors such as stigma, geographic distances, and health system responsiveness. The data from Ministry of Health in China here shows that almost half of the delays in TB diagnosis and therefore initiation of treatment was due to financial reasons. Despite the availability of services, the poor do not have the means to access it. Now, this data is a similar kind of data for the asthma treatment. You can see the vast variation between the cost of treatment between Algeria and Burkina Faso. It's about a fourfold increase. And ironically, the people who have to pay more have no or very limited access to health insurance. Again, this is an anomaly which can be prevented. Moving on to diagnosis, this particular data shows us that 8 countries in the world account for 60% of the undetected TB cases in the world in 2006. Now, there are 2 points to note here. Majority of the countries are low-income countries, probably with poor infrastructure and health systems. And the second point here is that there's a huge differential, even in this data, between the 8 countries, and India has 6 times more missed cases as compared to Bangladesh and South Africa. Let's look at the treatment disparities. This is work done by Christy Hansen and then put into a framework by Peter Tugwell, and it basically shows us that the ratio between the poor and the poorest in terms of actual effectiveness following treatment is fourfold. The poor is to poorest ratio is 4%, and you can see that even better illustrated in this graph here, that the expected number of cases among the poor is 4 times higher, but the number of poor who actually complete treatment is 4 times lesser than the non-poor. I'll move on to smoking. Smoking is more common in poor men as defined by income, education, social classes than the rich men in all countries. Now, this is data from Chennai, my hometown in India, and you can see here that the illiterate and the people who have less than 6 years of education have a threefold increase in smoking rates as compared to those who have higher education. The people on the lower rungs of the socioeconomic ladder are burdened disproportionately. Now, what about services provided to the smokers? The interventions and policies have a significant decrease on smoking trends in higher income groups. And this is data from Norwegian men over 35 years, and it shows that there's been a greater impact on people with a higher income as compared to those with a lower income. Again, poorer socioeconomic groups suffer the consequences of tobacco use more than the richer. Now, another inequity which we see largely today is about where people live, which affects their health and chances of leading a flourishing life. The year 2007, for the first time, half of the world's population started living in urban settings. Now, urbanization can be a positive determinant of health in appropriate circumstances. However, if rapid and unplanned urbanization occurs, there's a lot of problems. And the next two slides will illustrate this. This is data from Gambia, which shows that the people who have been suspected to have asthma in the rural and urban areas is much higher in the urban areas, but those who were actually diagnosed were about fourfold higher in the urban areas. Now, if you look at the Philippines data on tuberculosis, the national average is 300 per 100,000, but in the urban areas, whether you're poor or non-poor, you have a much higher rate of tuberculosis. Now, these are the consequences of rapid urbanization trends in the world today, and cities are becoming predominantly the mode of living, and this trend is irreversible. UN Habitat estimates that by the year 2030, 3 out of 5 people will be living in urban areas, and by the year of 2050, 3 out of 4 will be living in urban areas. This is a phenomenon which is irreversible. And if you consider that rapid unplanned urbanization is happening, you will see the similar kind of data, where the urban poor have much higher rates of tuberculosis and other infectious diseases as compared to the urban non-poor. Now, I hope I have convinced you enough with this data. You can go on and on about this data because there's so much of work done in these areas. But health inequities are the embodiment of social inequality. It is not due to individual failure, but it's rather a result of economic deprivation, discrimination, and inadequate public policies. Do you agree with me? Very good. A Sunday school teacher asked a question, why should your children be quiet in church on Sunday? And she got a very surprising answer. A five-year-old came and whispered into her ear, saying, because the adults are sleeping. I hope that's not the case. Because this is the better part, and this is where I want you to listen more carefully. Now, why does health systems matter? Well, the primary responsibility of public health systems can be seen as a means of ensuring health care for all, including the poor. And the health systems can act by promoting health equity through influencing investment decisions and public policies across government sectors, in a way to address the social determinants, which is the cause of health inequities. It can also indirectly affect through individual and community empowerment, and we can see, I'd like to present some examples of that today. Now, we all know about the health system challenges, and this is not new to us. If you look at the scale, safe, proven, and cheap interventions are not reaching the poor. If you look at the scope, comprehensive health services responding to the needs and expectations of people are not usual. If you look at the distribution, the unmet needs are disproportionately those with the lesser means. And if you look at protection, too many are still not receiving the benefits due to the encounters with the health system. And finally, the system's capabilities, we all know about this. Can our systems cope with new challenges like XDR and MDR-TB? Now, how can the health systems become more equitable, fair, and inclusive? Global health context has changed dramatically over the past decades. While progress has been made on several of these fronts, and I won't go through this because all of you have read about this and have probably researched on this, the response to the health sector is not changing adequately as the world is changing. The health system seems to be drifting from one short-term priority to the next, increasingly becoming fragmented and without a sense of direction. Now, not all the blame is due to the health sector. there are circumstances and trends which go beyond the health sector. For example, the structural adjustment programs. Now, WHO has done a lot of work on the potential risks and opportunities in all these areas, and I'd like to focus on the opportunities in two of these areas. I'll start with the decentralization, and we talk about increased local ownership and commitment to selected priorities. Now, this is a wonderful graph, and it shows what happened in an urban setting for smear-negative TB patients as treatment outcomes following decentralization. So the bars on the blue is pre-decentralization, and the bars on the red is post-decentralization. Now look at the amount of people who completed treatment. It's much higher. The defaulter rate is much lower. Now you would all agree that this is better health outcomes, even after decentralization. Another one, which is the increased role of the private sector and the NGO sectors, and the opportunity is to increase the involvement of the private sector by providing quality TB treatment. And this is data from India. After 5 years of implementing the public-private mix project, you can see that in 3 out of the 5 centers studied, the case detection rates over these 5 years by the private sector had doubled, and that is remarkable. Health is receiving much attention today. There's a growing interest in unifying our actions together. Now, the public sector leadership does not displace the responsibilities and capabilities of the other sector. As you can see in this graph of the number of top TB partners in a year ago, 62% of them were from the non-governmental sector. And this means close to 400 partners who are willing to work together with governments, academics, the corporate sector to provide comprehensive universal care. And this is unprecedented. I am sure you will agree with me that despite all the challenges, there are significant opportunities that are viable options for us to build upon and to take advantage of. Now, I'll move on to some ideas of how lung health can contribute to health system strengthening. I'd like to talk about 3 areas. The first one is governance. As I mentioned before, there are more funds available for the health than ever before, but it means that we have to have effective governance in order to achieve results. We have to engage all the care providers, we have to provide quality of care for our patients, and finally, we need to empower the communities. This, again, is a wonderful graph. It's the data on the cost and by the sources of funding over a 6-year period. Now, look at the scale of increase in funding from close to about $500 million to about reducing the graphs, you can see that it's a threefold increase over a 6-year period. Now, I'd like you to focus in the last bar, which is the black section, and that is purely government funds. And this is very important for us to understand that developing countries today are not aid dependent. Global aid is important and will supplement and support those countries which are making slow progress, but that is not the mainstay. Real progress will come when there is better governance and investments from all countries. Of course, as you can see here, the Global Fund and other new mechanisms have supported what the developing countries can do. This decade has also seen an increase in the number of innovative global funding mechanisms relating to global solidarity. And we heard from our French delegate today about the French development funds. This is another one, which is the International Health Partnership, which was launched in September of last year by the UK Prime Minister Gordon Brown and Norwegian Prime Minister Jens Stoltenberg, in response to the challenges of reaching the health-related MDGs. There is a need to align this increase in funds to, according to country priorities in order to improve the governance architecture. The investments are going to be in building and strengthening of health services, which are crucial for scaling up coverage and for the use of health systems. As you can see in this red centerpiece, the outputs which are expected are in the areas of health system strengthening, and governance, human resources, medical products, and information are the four areas which are expected to produce some results. International cooperation of this nature will accelerate the conversion of the health systems through better channeling of funds which are available today. And there are funds which are available today, and I'm told that Ethiopia and Mozambique are the first ones which will benefit from these kind of resources which are available for health system strengthening. So today we cannot argue and say that we don't have money for the health system strengthening. We need to find a way to build on these kind of opportunities. Oops. What did I do? Okay, I'd now like to give you an example of another program in which I worked. This is the trachoma program. And the health services in Ghana has this problem, especially in the northern part of the country, and they trained a number of health workers to do this simple 15-minute surgery of the eyelid and had them placed in all the health services in the northern part of Ghana. But as you can see from the data in 2001, they were only able to do approximately 300 to 400 surgeries a year, much lower than what was needed. Then they started working with the local community to find out why people were not accessing the services which were available at the health facilities. The sad story was that most of these people were elderly and need to walk several hours to days to reach the health facility and therefore prefer to stay back in their yards, really suffering from redness and pain. Their eyelashes are pointing inwards and they can't do anything about it. Once they discussed this with the chiefs of the villages, one particular village chief said that, come and do the surgery in my compound and we'll see how many people will come there. And this actually increased the number of cases which happened to be willing to come and have surgeries done. So this kind of initiative by one village chief then spread around the whole district, and you can see how the data increased, and they were able to do 10,000 and 12,000 1,000 to 1,200 surgeries per year. We need to empower the people who are most impacted by the disparities to find local solutions. This kind of community participation and social participation in policy and service delivery can bring positive results and strengthen the health systems. This was additional to what the health systems could have provided. Now, the second area where we need to probably invest is to improve the laboratory network. And we all know about the gaps in case detection, and that needs to be addressed urgently. Again, this is a policy failure. The limitations in the tools have to be addressed, and more importantly, this should be seen as a strategic opportunity, not only for TB control, but for better health systems in general. Now, the TB program also has done a lot of work in establishing supranational reference laboratories, but I'm most impressed by the work which has been done by the Stop TB Partnership in response to the XDR and MDR cases, where they've developed a very aggressive global response. And this is to establish 43 new laboratories in 2 years, perform 4 million cultures, save more than 135,000 lives at a cost of $2.1 billion. And this is on public website, and this is what the Stop TB Partnership has decided to do. Now, investment in these kind of healthcare systems based on the principles of primary healthcare and the approach is very, very important. We have to start with the supranational laboratories, go down to national, and then go down to provincial and district level. Now, this is what WHO is looking to do to revitalize the primary healthcare approach, and it's talking about four reforms in these areas: with universal coverage, ensuring health equity, service delivery around people's needs, public policy for healthier communities, and leadership which is both inclusive and participatory. Now, the third area which I think we should probably do is to gather very good evidence. The WHO's Commission on Social Determinants of Health released its report earlier this year in August, and it made three key recommendations. And one of them is to measure and understand the problem and assess the impact of action. Now, no data, we all know, means that there is no recognition of the problem. Good data, on the other hand, is essential to understand the scale of the problems, to assess the impact of interventions, and monitor progress. Acknowledging that there is a problem and ensuring that health inequity is measured within countries and globally is a vital platform for action. Now, again, this is excellent work done by the WHO TB program, and credit needs to go to Dr. Mario Reviglioni. I don't know whether he's here. In the early 1990s, he was responsible for the surveillance department when this was put together. As you can see, this kind of data is now being collected on an annual basis, and you are able to measure exactly where you are globally. And this is not done by one agency alone. This is not WHO alone. This is active participation of the several Stop TB partners who are contributing to the collection of the data. It also has to be presented in a very simple way and in an innovative way so that it's easily understandable for policymakers so they can make some informed decisions. And again, this kind of data is not easy to find in many other disease control programs. In all that we do, we have to have a stronger focus on social determinants, and that requires more public health research. Operational research provides decision makers with the information to enable them to improve program performance. And there are several successful global programs who have seriously invested in operational research. The onchocerciasis program, which was to eliminate river blindness, deliberately set aside 10 to 15% of their funds for operational research. Now, I'm pleased to see in the website of the Global Fund that they have recognized the role of operational research and strongly encourage the countries to write proposals with an operational research component. But there is one caveat. The operational research must be aligned to national health priorities. And I like the work done by the Eastern Mediterranean region of WHO. Since 2000, they have tried to build the capacity of the national program managers, and you can read more about this in the 2001 June TDR news. What they have done is remarkable. They have put together a very successful program where the program implementers and researchers, both national as well as international, contributed to every stage of the research, identifying the problem, design of the research protocol, dissemination of the results, and utilization of the findings. Now, I'd like to conclude by saying that the health systems is part of the solution. It should not be seen as part of the problem. We have to put people at the center of the healthcare, and such kind of an approach will improve the community health. If you want to narrow down the health inequalities, we need to measure it, and then we need to be bold to take action. Narrow incremental work is not the answer. We need to have wide-ranging initiatives with public policy resources committed to address health inequities. Better quality of life will be provided if we can find what those inequities are and use the systems to deliver appropriate interventions to those who are marginalized. And this is what is embodied in the Talent Charter, which was adopted by the European region of WHO this year in August in a meeting, and they have put more emphasis and priority in health system strengthening based on the primary healthcare model. Now, I'd like to tell you two sentences about the work which we do. This is a center for health development which is based in Japan, and our goal is to reduce health inequities in urban settings. And this is a deliberate decision which was taken by some visionary people 10 years ago to look at research which will identify the health inequities, but secondly, looking at governance which will address them through the mayors and other policymakers in urban settings. Before I end, I want to thank my two friends, Don Ennison and Ian Smith, who helped me with this presentation. But I'd like to leave you with this thought. All of us make choices in life. Now, you have a choice to make today. You've heard about health inequities. You've heard that there is some data which is available, but not routinely collected data which addresses health inequities. But all of us are called to do some good work to impact upon the poor, and you are called upon to do work on lung health, and you're committed to do that goal. I'd like to ask you that you make a strategic choice that you, in your work, as you go back from this conference, you will try to find the means of addressing the inequities. If we don't, we will be reaching whom we have reached in the past. And by so doing, you will contribute to the better health of your fellow citizens and leave a legacy of a better world for our future generations to follow. Thank you very much.
Jacob, thank you very much indeed. A very stimulating lecture, certainly for me, I'm sure for you. Clearly a topic dear to mine and many other people's hearts in the audience. So maybe just a further round of applause for Jacob on that. So that concludes our special guest lecture with that enticing question about health systems and inequity. I think Jacob has given us a call to arms. We change gear now and move on to the awards ceremony of the union. And I wonder if I could have the slides back again. I think you're fed up with looking at me. So the union awards were established to recognize exceptional contributions to tuberculosis and lung disease. And the first of these awards that we're going to move on to tonight is the Union Scientific Award. And I'd like to introduce and ask Michael Kimmeling, Dr. Michael Kimmeling, who chairs the Union's Coordinating Committee on Scientific Affairs, to make the first.
Thank you, Bertie, and welcome everyone to the conference at Paris. And excuse my voice. Jacob, you didn't talk about laryngitis in your data on urban health. Anyway, it was befitting. I'm very happy to be able to present this award. The Union Scientific Award is awarded to a researcher, a young researcher under the age of 45, who's made a significant contribution to the research literature. And our prize tonight falls or fits nicely in with Jacob's discussion and his emphasis on operational research and what it has to offer programs in terms of development and enhancing their effectiveness. The prize is to be awarded to Dr. Ronnie Zachariah. In his place tonight is Mr. Tony Reed, because Ronnie couldn't make it. But Dr. Zachariah went to medical school in Nigeria and did diploma degrees in both London and in the University of Dublin. He completed his PhD in 2004 at the University of Amsterdam, where he did his doctoral research on many aspects of healthcare in rural Malawi, including HIV/AIDS, TB, TB-HIV, and STI. Currently, Dr. Zachariah, thank you. Okay. Currently, Dr. Zachariah is the Director of Operational Research and Documentation for Médecins Sans Frontières in Brussels, Belgium. The paper he's being cited for was published in 2007, in which he discussed the importance or the relationship of ART therapy to TB care, and he showed no decline in mortality when ARV therapy is delayed and instituted after TB care is completed, at least the first initial phase. This result was a bit shocking to the community, who was not clear about the sequencing of TB and HIV care. So this raised many issues, and it's for this paper that he's being recognized tonight. So I would like to invite Mr. Tony Reed to accept the award for Dr. Zachariah. Thank you very much.
Thank you all very much. I'm very sorry that Ronnie could not be here. I'm a colleague of his, and I work in the operational research unit in Brussels. Ronnie had to choose between his desire to be here with his TB colleagues and to be with his sister, who was getting married this week in India. So he asked me to convey this message. I would like to express my sincere gratitude to the union for this prize. I'm especially happy that it gives recognition and due credibility to the role of program-oriented operational research in shaping policy and practice for managing TB in resource-limited settings. I consider this award a recognition of the work of all MSF workers, our partners, community workers, and TB patients, and this honor is thus very much a shared one. As we continue to face challenges in both the patient and program levels in taking care of TB patients, particularly those co-infected with HIV or suffering from MDR-TB, the absence of political will and support for TB can be a significant bottleneck for opening new projects. I would therefore like to take this opportunity to specifically appeal to the Chinese government to allow MSF teams to access MDR-TB patients who've been waiting for more than a year for a formal green light. I would like to thank my friends and colleagues, especially from Malawi and particularly Professor Felix Salani-Poni, the National TB Control Program, and I extend a special gratitude to Professor A.D. Harries, who introduced me, an MSF, to operational research, and to Professor Martin Borgdorf, both of whom have guided me over the years and from whom I have taken inspiration and direction. I would like to close by indicating that the money from this prize will be used to contribute towards an educational fund for TB-HIV orphans. Thank you very much from Ronnie and from MSF.
Thank you, Michael. So the next prize is the Union Carol Stebo Public Health Prize, which acknowledges a health worker, physician or layperson, for contributions to tuberculosis control or non-tuberculous lung disease. And it's a great pleasure to announce that the recipient this year is Chief Austin Obiafuna from the Afro-Global Alliance in Ghana. Chief Austin Arinze Obiafuna has demonstrated a leadership role and a strong crusading spirit in the fight against tuberculosis. He maintains this belief that if an individual is affected, the community is affected, and so the entire globe, meaning that TB knows no boundary. In 2003, he established the Afro-Global Alliance in Ghana and started the formation of the Stop TB Partnership in Ghana in 2005, which was inaugurated in 2007, with membership of over 100 NGOs. He specialized in journalism management and health education consultancy from Umuoji in Indimili, North LGA, in Anambra State in Nigeria. Among his many achievements, he includes being the founder and president of the Afro-Global Alliance International and the national coordinator of Stop TB Ghana. Chief Austin has played enormous roles in the fight against TB through innovative initiatives like the TB Voice Network he founded in 2007, which happens to be the first patient-led group in Ghana aimed at demystifying TB, the Global TB Candlelight Meditation also in 2007, which is a grassroots program helped to shake the face of TB by eliminating stigma. He's presented papers on TB control in conferences and has worked as a WHO consultant on establishing national Stop TB partnerships. At the moment, he's leading the advocacy role of declaring TB as a national emergency in Ghana, involving traditional authorities in TB control and the establishment. He's also involved in the establishment of a supranational laboratory in the West African region. So I call on Chief Austin to receive the Carol Stebro Prize.
Thank you very much. I wish to thank the union for this award. To me, it's a tool, a motivational tool. I want to thank my organization, Afro Global Alliance, for their support, and other bodies like the TB Voice Network, the Ghana Health Service, the National Tuberculosis Control Program Ghana, and there is one person too that if you lift the veil of this success, the success of this award, he's conspicuous there, and he's one and only Dr. Bonsu, my program manager. I wish to use this opportunity to tell him that I appreciate him a lot. Thank you very much. And the prize for this award, I'm going to use it to still continue the advocacy work of making sure that the government, you know, declare TB as a national emergency in Ghana. Thank you.
We move on now, ladies and gentlemen, to the Princess Chichibu Global TB Memorial Award. And I'd invite at this stage Dr. Tadao Shimao, Director Emeritus of RIT JATA and Senior Advisor to the Japanese Anti-Tuberculosis Association.
Distinguished participants of the 39th Union World Conference on Lung Health, ladies and gentlemen, it is my great honor and pleasure to donate this year's Princess Chichibu Memorial TB Global Award to Professor Anne Fanning. But before doing so, allow me to speak briefly about Princess Chichibu. Her Imperial Highness Princess Chichibu had been the patroness of Japan TB Association since its foundation in 1939 until her death in 1995 for 56 years. In 1940, 1 year after she started to serve as the patroness of JATA, her husband, Prince Chichibu, younger brother of the former Emperor Showa, got TB. And in spite of the best then available treatment by attending physicians and good care taken by Her Imperial Highness, Prince Chichibu finally passed away in 1953 after 13 years' struggle against tuberculosis. While she had to take care of her husband, she also engaged several official duties as a patroness of JATA. She had devoted herself after his death. She had devoted herself for the fight against TB and encouraging those who are working against TB. Her major concern was to organize women for the fight against tuberculosis, as it was her firm belief that if women are well acquainted with tuberculosis, then she can protect her family and neighbors from the damage caused by tuberculosis. Finally, in 1975, the National Federation of the Women's Organization engaging in the fight against tuberculosis was organized. And this organization has been working in close cooperation with the central and local governments, first in tuberculosis and now improving health in general. Her Imperial Highness Chichibu also showed keen interest in international cooperation in TB control. This year, 2008, is the 45th anniversary of the international training course organized at RIT JATA, and since its very beginning in 1953, she organized a reception to the course participants and had a talk with them and encouraged their activities. In 1980, she visited Nepal through the invitation of by Nepal Anti-TB Association and observed field activities and talked with them and encouraged the staff working in the TB control project. After her visit, the cooperation of Japan in the western part of Nepal was integrated to the cooperation in National TB Control Program, and the National TB Institute was constructed by grant aid from Japan in Timi near Kathmandu, not only at the Center for TB Control in Nepal, but also in South countries. Recognizing great contribution of Her Imperial Highness Princess Chichibu, not only in TB control in Japan, but also for global TB control, Japan Anti-TB Association created Princess Chichibu Memorial TB Awards, including this TB Global Award in 1998. Now it is my great honor and pleasure representing Japan Anti-TB Association to donate this year's Princess Chichibu Memorial TB Global Award to Professor Anne Fanning for her great contribution in TB control, research, and education, teaching on TB, not only in Canada and North America, but also in the world, including her activities as president of the International Union Against Tuberculosis and Lung Disease from 2000-2003. Professor Anne Fanning, would you mind to come up? This is the certificate and signed by Princess Akishino, the new patroness succeeding Princess Chichibu. And this is the double belt cross symbol of the SEAL campaign.
This is wonderful. Thank you very much.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Professor Schmoyle, thank you from the bottom of my heart. I am enormously honored by this award. I'm inspired by the story of the devotion of the late Princess Chichibu and by the work that the Japanese Anti-TB Association has done for so many years. And to learn of the Japanese government's further commitment to the Center to Explore Health Inequities, I commit to you that if I live long enough, I will try to earn this award. And I want to tell you that I have earned it on the shoulders of giants who humble me. And it will be put into a trust fund at my university to inspire young people to global health careers. Thank you.
We now move on to the award of the StopTB Partnership Pochon Prize. And I'd like to call on Dr. Marcos Espinal, Executive Secretary of the StopTB Partnership, to make the presentation.
Good evening, everyone. It is a pleasure to introduce Mr. Doo Yung Kim, Chairman of the Kochon Foundation, who has been sponsoring this award for the last 3 years. Mr. Kim.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. On behalf of the Kochon Foundation, I'm thrilled to be here to award the StopTB Partnership Kochon Prize to the individuals and organizations devoted to the fight against tuberculosis. This is the third award ceremony since we became a partner of StopTB Partnership. We are pleased to share attention to the prize growing every year and the selection committee putting more effort and time in deciding on award recipients. The prize was established in the memory of Jong-un Lee, who founded a pharmaceutical company in South Korea in 1941. He paid special attention to TB, and his company became a leading manufacturer of anti-TB drugs. By bequeathing his personal assets, Mr. Lee established the Kochon Foundation in 1973 with the aim of supporting students in financial need and donate funds to biomedical institutions. His legacy has been maintained as it should. I am proud to say this prize is very much in line with the founder's wishes. The Kochon Prize is a humble attempt to recognize the achievements of people who work and day and night in communities, laboratories, health ministries, and beyond to being the dream of a TB-free world a step closer. We hope the prize recognizes winners for what they have done and also inspires them to move forward and fully implement the global plan to stop TB. We all know TB can strike anyone, anywhere. So the credit for fighting this disease should go to those who are on the front lines, no matter where. With this in mind, I'm delighted to give the floor to Dr. Marcos Espinal, Executive Secretary of the StopTB Partnership, for the announcement of the winners of the 2008 STOP TV Partnership Culture Prize. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman Kim. Again, let me thank the union for allowing the STOP TV Partnership Cochon Foundation Award to be given at this ceremony. The coordinating board of the STOP TV Partnership decided to award the Cochon Partnership Award to two outstanding members of the TV community. Upon recommendations of the panel assigned by the coordinating board, our first awardee is Dr. Jaime Bayona of Socios en Salud. It is indeed a great pleasure to award Dr. Jaime Bayona this award for remarkable achievements in the development and subsequent international expansion of community-based multidrug-resistant tuberculosis treatment in a resource-poor setting. Jaime Bayona is the founding director of Socios en Salud, Sucursal Peru, a Lima-based organization that has had significant impact on policies for prevention and treatment of drug-resistant tuberculosis and HIV, and provided training and technical assistance around the world. He is a leader in international health and social medicine. Dr. Bayona is an authority on programmatic approaches to the control of multidrug-resistant TB. I'm a longtime advocate for community-based primary care. He's the author of numerous publications related to TB control and treatment methods, and is currently a co-investigator in a multi-institutional grant funded by the U.S. National Institute of Health to study the epidemiology of multidrug-resistant TB in Lima. Dr. Bayona received his MD in 1986 from the School of Medicine, National University of Trujillo in Peru, and his MPH in 1992 from the Joint Center for Public Health Studies, College of Medicine, University of Wales, UK. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Bayona.
Good evening, everyone. On behalf of the whole Socios en Salud team, I would like to thank the selection committee for awarding us this prize. Many are the individuals and institutions we are grateful to for their unconditional support to accomplish our mission. However, because of time constraints, I will not be able to mention each and every one of them, but I'm sure that they know that we are now thinking of them with gratitude. I must say how grateful we are to the great Partners in Health family around the world, with whom each day we seek to spread the pragmatic solidarity network in support of MDR-TB treatment for patients. My special recognition to the staff of the Peruvian Ministry of Health for allowing us to collaborate with them and fight against resistant tuberculosis in Peru. Finally, my special gratitude to the health promoters, members of the community within and with them we work. They are the depositories and brilliant translators of many of the lessons learned. Mi especial agradecimiento a nuestros pacientes por quienes nosotros consideramos que apoyarlos seguirá siendo hasta el final nuestro deber. La fortaleza que ellos nos dan para lograr nuestra misión es una deuda que siempre tendremos con ellos. Thank you very much.
Okay. Now, I have the great pleasure to, which I would never expected I was going to do that in my life, to present the award to one of the, if not the greatest, of what we have today known as treatment for tuberculosis. For groundbreaking research that led to the development of the current treatment for TB, for having remarkably contributed to improvement in the chemotherapy of Mycobacterium TB, we most of all, many of us grew up with his research. We have learned a lot from him, and I believe we all should be grateful for his contribution. Dennis Mitchinson has had a distinguished career in tuberculosis research, beginning with his pioneering studies on anti-tuberculosis chemotherapy more than half a century ago. The author of 245 scientific papers. He is the recipient of many awards, including the Weber Parks Prize Medal, Royal College of Physicians, the Philip Medal Chest and Heart Association, the Medal of Honor, International Union Against Tuberculosis and Lung Disease, the Presidential Award, American Thoracic Society, the Severi Savonen Medal, Finnish Lung Health Association, and the British Thoracic Society Medal. A graduate of Trinity College at Cambridge and University College Hospital Medical School, he completed postgraduate studies in pathology before beginning studies on streptomycin at Brompton Hospital in 1947 as one of the three people on the original bacteriological committee. In 1956, he was appointed director of the Medical Research Council Unit for Research on Drug Sensitivity in Tuberculosis at the Royal Postgraduate Medical School in Hammersmith, now Imperial College. In that role, he was responsible for the design of groundbreaking randomized trials in Madras, India, comparing inpatient and outpatient treatment of TB, the first major studies of home care. In 1985, Dr. Mitchinson retired from his position, but not from science. He continued his work at Hammersmith for 4 years, before moving to St. George's University of London, where he has continued an active career in tuberculosis research. Ladies and gentlemen, Professor Emeritus Dennis Mitchinson, what a great honor.
It's a great honor for me, but my thoughts go back some 60 years to when I started taking an interest in TB, very largely by chance, I may say. But at that time, this was a disease that killed half of the people who developed it, where you had young people developing tuberculous meningitis who inevitably died an unpleasant, painful death. Now we have weapons that we can hope eventually to eliminate the disease. But that has been a huge endeavor with a very large number of people all over the world contributing. And although I hope I have played a part in this, I would not for a moment say that there are others who have played at least as important and in many ways more important part. And in particular, I would draw your attention to Professor Wallace Fox, with whom I collaborated for some 40 years, who is unfortunately not well enough now to receive medals. But these are the people who really altered the world of tuberculosis. I must thank the Union for its work. I remember when it started as a little organization almost in a hole in the corner in the way it started. Now a very different situation. I must thank the Union and also Dr. Kirchhoff and the Foundation for this very generous gift. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So, ladies and gentlemen, that concludes our inaugural session for this conference. It only remains for me to thank and congratulate all of those who stood at this podium tonight. I wish you all in the audience a very successful and constructive conference, and I urge you to think forward to Cancun, December 2009, where the theme of our conference will be poverty and lung health. And finally, I welcome you to the cocktail reception. There should be signs as you leave the auditorium. And I urge you, please, to return your headsets. If you don't, the Union suffers. Thank you.